From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I want to know how you coordinated the evacuation.
By urging the governor and the mayor to order the mandatory evacuation.
And that's coordinating?
What would you like for me to do, Congressman?
Well, and that's why I'm happy you left. Because that kind of, you know, look in the in the lights like a deer tells me that you weren't capable to do the job.
President Bush called him Brownie. Now, will the former FEMA head, Michael Brown, be his fall guy? Then four Catholic peace activists are acquitted of felony conspiracy charges.
The jury found the war illegal and the government lost a tool to stifle dissent.
We'll be joined by two members of the St. Patrick's Four. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Puerto Rico, tens of thousands attended the memorial and funeral services for Puerto Rican nationalist leader Filiberto Ojeda Rios, who was shot dead Friday by FBI agents. It's believed to be one of the largest funerals in Puerto Rican history. El Diario newspaper is reporting over 1,000 vehicles took part in a caravan from San Juan to the eastern town of Naguabo, where he was buried. Amnesty International is calling for an independent investigation into the shooting. Amnesty said the killing should be considered an extrajudicial execution. If the FBI deliberately killed Ojeda Rios or deliberately left him to die when they could have arrested him. FBI agents shot him Friday night at his home, but then waited 20 hours before entering the house. Autopsy reports show he bled to death. His wife, Elma Rosado Barboso, told Monday that FBI agents fired first, but the FBI denies this. Ojeda Rios had been living underground for 15 years, was wanted for his role in a $7 million bank heist. The militant group that Ojeda Rios led, Los Macheteros, issued a statement Tuesday saying they would avenge his death. The killing has outraged Puerto Ricans of all political stripes, especially because it occurred on September 23rd, the anniversary of an 1868 uprising against Spanish rule. New York Congressmember Jose Serrano said he's considered this is the beginning of a new government crackdown on the Puerto Rican independence movement. On Monday, FBI Director Robert Mueller responded to increasing criticism by announcing an independent investigation into the shooting. In Washington, the former head of FEMA, Michael Brown, defended his agency's response to Hurricane Katrina and laid much of the blame on what he described as the dysfunctional state and local governments in Louisiana. Brown appeared before a congressional hearing Tuesday that was largely boycotted by Democrats who are seeking an independent probe. Brown also said FEMA's response was hurt by the Bush administration's focus on the so-called war on terror at the expense of domestic emergency operations. Brown said FEMA was short 500 people in an organization of 2,500. We'll have more on the hearing in a few minutes. In other news on Hurricane Katrina, the New Orleans Times-Picayune is reporting the vast majority of reported atrocities committed by evacuees have turned out to be false. The paper said most of the horror stories that emerged from the Superdome have never been confirmed. Police now say six people died inside the Superdome, four from natural causes, one from a drug overdose, one suicide. They have no official reports of rape and no eyewitnesses to sexual assault. The Los Angeles Times reports that, quote, race may have played a factor in the wild rumors that spread through much of the media. In Iraq, at least six people have been killed by a suspected female suicide bomber in an attack on an army recruitment center in northern Iraq. The BBC reports if this is confirmed, it would be the first known use of a woman bomber in Iraq since the end of the war. Meanwhile, Lindy England has been sentenced to 3 years in prison for her role in abusing Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib. Her sentence fell well short of the maximum 10-year sentence she faced. The 22-year-old Army reservist was photographed holding a naked Iraqi prisoner by a leash and pointing to a prisoner's genitals. Meanwhile, an Army captain has accused the Pentagon of being more concerned about tracking down soldiers who report detainee abuse than in investigating the accusation. organizations. Army Captain Ian Fishback recently helped provide Human Rights Watch with information on new cases of abuse and torture taking part in U.S. prisons in Iraq. Fishback said the Army's now threatening to file charges against him if he disobeys an order to disclose the names of two Army sergeants who also spoke to Human Rights Watch. Fishback told the New York Times, quote, "We came forward because of the larger issue that prisoner abuse is systemic in the Army. I'm concerned this will take a new twist and they'll try to scapegoat some of the younger soldiers. This is a leadership problem," he said. In other military news, the Army is investigating complaints that soldiers posted photographs of Iraqi corpses on an internet site in exchange for access to pornographic images on the site. Many of the photos depict dismembered Iraqi corpses and body parts. Some also were submitted by soldiers in Afghanistan. A U.S. immigration judge has ruled Cuban exile Luis Posada Carriles won't be deported to Cuba or Venezuela, where he's wanted for his role in blowing up a Cuban jetliner in 1976, killing 73 people. The former CIA operative has spent four decades trying to destabilize and overthrow the Cuban government through assassination attempts and bombings. He's been in U.S. custody since May after he illegally entered the country. Venezuela had asked that he be extradited to stand trial. On Tuesday, the immigration judge ruled Posada would not be deported to either country because of the possibility he would be tortured there. The Convention Against Torture Act prohibits the United States from deporting someone to a country where they could be tortured. Venezuela condemned the decision. The judge's decision has not ruled out the removal of Posada to another country. Israel has begun firing artillery shells into the northern Gaza Strip in an intensification of its five-day offensive. Haaretz newspaper reports this marks the first time Israel has used cannons against targets in the Gaza Strip since the 1967 Six-Day War. Much of Gaza City is now without power after a series of Israeli airstrikes. Haaretz reports a missile strike, a building used by the ruling Fatah Party to provide tutoring lessons to school children and cash and food assistance to families. Israel's justified the attack, saying they're needed to stop Palestinians from firing rockets into Israel. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Israel shut down and sealed 15 offices of different social welfare organizations, claiming they're funneling funds to families whose members were killed in suicide bombings or jailed in Israelis' prisons. And over 400 Palestinians have been arrested in recent days. In labor news, leaders of the AFL-CIO's breakaway unions met to officially form a new labor federation called the Change to Win Federation. Anna Berger of SEIU was selected as the federation's chairwoman, and Edgar Romney of Unite Here was selected as treasurer. It's the first time a woman and an African-American, respectively, have reached such pinnacles of leadership in the U.S. labor movement. The group announced one of its chief goals will be to organize workers at Walmart. The Supreme Court has agreed to take up a case that may determine the future of the country's campaign finance laws. 30 years ago, the court ruled the government may limit how much money donors give to candidates, but it may not limit how much the candidates spend. The case centers on a Vermont state law that caps spending in races for governor at $300,000 per candidate, with smaller caps for other state offices. Backers of the law's provisions say a favorable ruling from the high court could stem the ever-growing tide of big money in politics. Critics of the law say limiting spending on campaigns improperly impinges free speech. And in Texas, attorneys for House Majority Leader Tom DeLay have expressed concern that DeLay may be indicted for conspiracy for his role in funneling corporate money to support state candidates in violation of state law. Two associates of DeLay have already been indicted. House Republican rules require any member of the elected leadership to step down temporarily if indicted, and it would be up to the rank and file to select an interim replacement. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The ousted director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, Michael Brown, appeared before a special congressional panel set up by House Republican leaders to investigate the disastrous response to the Hurricane Katrina. Brown defended FEMA's actions and proceeded to blame local and state officials for the subsequent catastrophe in New Orleans, which killed at least 1,000 people and caused hundreds of billions of dollars in damage. Brown blamed Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco and New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin on what he called a dysfunctional local response. Both officials are Democrats. In contrast, Brown praised state officials in Alabama and Mississippi, saying their response to the disaster was effective. Governors of those states are Republican. Brown also defended himself against what he called, quote, false, defamatory statements reported by the news media about his qualifications. Apparently, Brown was referring to news reports that came out in the days after Katrina hit, showing his previous job was as a commissioner for the International Arabian Horse Association, that he had minimal experience in disaster management before he was appointed head of FEMA. Democrats have protested the Republican congressional leadership's decision to lead House and Senate inquiries into the government's failed Katrina response. They charge the president's party cannot be impartial in investigating the administration. Democrats initially boycotted the hearing, calling it a whitewash. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi slammed the hearing as a sham photo opportunity orchestrated by Republican leadership in lieu of stringent congressional oversight of the administration. However, Democratic Congressmember William Jefferson from Louisiana and Jane Taylor from Mississippi did participate in the hearings. Here is what some of Congressmember Jane Taylor had to say to Brown.
And you can try to throw as much as you can on this, on the backs of Louisianans, but I'm a witness as to what happened in Mississippi. You folks fell on your face. You get an F minus in my book. Now we are into the bureaucratic stage. But even now, I'm not pleased with what I'm seeing because, you know, again, you're trying to throw the monkey on the backs of the disconnect. The disconnect was people thought there was some federal expertise out there. It wasn't, not from you. When it arrived in the form of the National Guard. So my next question is, does FEMA even take into account the fact that half of the Mississippi National Guard was in Iraq? And that, to the best of my knowledge, a substantial number of the Louisiana National Guard were in Iraq on the day of the storm? Because your local rep insisted on only one point of delivery because he would not have the food in other places and said he wasn't going to do it because there were no National Guardsmen to protect the food. So did you take into account the fact that half the Mississippi National Guard was in Iraq the day of the storm?
I'm not going to get into a debate with you about National Guard in Iraq, but I will tell you that under the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, EMAC, we have, and our, and states have, the governors have, Governor Barbour does, has available to them National Guard troops from all over this country to come in and assist them. And I've never had a problem or heard of a problem from any governor saying they couldn't get sufficient National Guard troops to help them.
I wish you had been at the Hancock County Emergency Operations Center, as we had approximately 100 volunteers from Florida, either state troopers or local policemen, who were there.
That means the EMAC system was working then. Then that means the EMAC system was working, and those people showed up to do what they're supposed to do under the assistance compact.
And your local rep insisted on one point of delivery because he didn't have National Guardsmen to go out to different points to deliver the food. It wasn't working. The fact is, those policemen sat at the EOC doing nothing when they could have been delivering food. Are you aware of that?
No, I'm not aware of every single county.
Maybe the president made a very good move when he asked you to leave your job.
Mississippi Democratic Congressmember Jane Taylor questioning Michael Brown at Tuesday's congressional hearing. Some of the strongest criticism of Brown came from Republican Congressmember Christopher Shays of Connecticut.
Now with the non-evacuation, when you knew that neither the governor our mayor were going to do their job, did you call, and I'd like to bring the president in, when did you contact the president to say, we have a catastrophe happening with an incompetent mayor and incompetent governor not responding to this? When did you contact the president to let him know of this extraordinary crisis that would impact our country?
I talked to the White House on both Saturday and Sunday, and then throughout the
first conversation was Saturday?
I think the first conversation was Saturday, yes. Why it may have been Friday, but I have to go back and check my record.
Why not sooner? I mean, you had indications that this was, I mean, we knew on Friday that it was going to hit New Orleans, and we knew by Friday that it was going to be basically a Category 4 or 5. You had a pretty good sense that the mayor and governor were not interacting with each other. And you basically had, even then, you wanted them to evacuate, right, on Friday.
Yes, that's the plan.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay, and they didn't implement it. So did you ask for, quote unquote, a higher authority to help you out so you could help save lives?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question, sir?
Did you ask for a higher authority to help you out? You're the head of FEMA, but the governor and mayor aren't paying attention to you. I want to know who you asked for help.
On Saturday and Sunday, I started talking to the White House.
To who?
On Saturday and Sunday, I started talking to the White House.
The White House is a big place. Mm-hmm. So give us specifics. I'm not asking about conversations yet. I want to know who you contacted.
I exchanged emails and phone calls with Joe Hagan, Andy Card, and the president.
Okay. And what was their reaction and what was their suggestions on how you should deal with this issue?
They offered to do whatever they could do, and we're going to start making phone calls. And
what did you ask them to do?
Now Brown is consulting with his attorney. They're whispering to each other.
Well, I'm being advised by counsel that I can't discuss with you my conversations with the president's chief of staff and the president.
Mr. Brown, you discussed it with the New York Times.
Yes.
So I think you could release what you shared with the New York Times, I think you could share with this committee.
I told them we needed help.
And what specific kind of help were you asking? You don't have to tell me the reaction right now. I want to know, what specifically did you ask?
To get the mayor and the governor to order a mandatory evacuation.
By the time the evacuation occurred on the 27th, that's Saturday, it was voluntary on the 27th, which blows me away, and on the 28th it was mandatory. That's less than 24 hours before the storm. How were people to evacuate that late in?
Well, that's the whole issue of doing an earlier evacuation.
Okay, but they didn't. And so what did you achieve by getting them to have a mandatory evacuation on the 28th?
To save lives and get additional people out of there.
I thought you told
me. They still could have done that.
Yeah. No, but on the 28th, in other words, FEMA's supposed to be aware of the plan on how you evacuate. I want to know how the plan to evacuate, how you were helping to organize the plan to evacuate, because you are a coordinator. I did listen to that, and you were very clear that your job is to coordinate. I want to know how you coordinated the evacuation.
By urging the governor and the mayor to order the mandatory evacuation.
And that's coordinating?
What would you like for me to do, Congressman?
Well, and that's why I'm happy you left, because that kind of, you know, look in the lights like a deer tells me that you weren't capable to do the job. I would have liked you to do a lot of things.
I take great umbrage to that comment, Congressman.
Why?
Because FEMA did. What people are missing in this entire conversation is the fact that FEMA did more in Hurricane Katrina than it did in Charlie and Florida and the others.
Why is that?
We moved all of those in there. We did all of those things. And things were working in Mississippi, and things were working in Alabama.
No, but see,
I guess you want me to be the superhero that is going to step in there and suddenly take everybody out of New Orleans.
No, what I wanted you to do was do your job of coordinating. And I want to know what you did to coordinate. Those are your words, sir. I didn't understand.
And coordinating is talking to the governor and the mayor and encouraging them to do their obligation to their citizens. I am not a dictator, and I'm not going and cannot go in there and force them to do that.
No, see, what I think that is just talk. It's not coordinating. Were you in contact with the military?
Yes, we were making contacts with the military on Saturday and Sunday.
Will the gentleman yield for just a second? Let me ask you to try to get to this. Did you get all the assets that you requested from the Department of Homeland Security and from the White House? Were they timely in giving you everything you needed?
Yes.
So you got everything you asked for?
Yes. All right. We were getting what we needed. We were getting what we needed to coordinate.
Some of the congressional questioning of FEMA director, former FEMA director, Michael Brown, at Tuesday's hearing. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, will he be the fall guy for the Bush administration? How high up does responsibility go? All that and more coming up. Archie Shepp here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 375 stations around the country, on Pacifica, NPR, and low-power FM stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, as well as both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on channel 375 of DirecTV. And we are podcasting, video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also on our website in Spanish, audio as well as transcript. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our coverage of the congressional panel where FEMA director, the former FEMA director, Michael Brown, was questioned, joined in our New York in Washington studio by Allison Young, reporter with Knight Ridder, who co-wrote a recent piece about how Homeland Security Director Michael Chertoff actually had more authority to respond to Hurricane Katrina than did Michael Brown. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, why don't you lay out what you think of the chain of command was and what Michael Chertoff's role was?
Well, the entire response has been interesting. Hearing all of the finger pointing about the lack of command and control on the ground in the hurricane zone during Katrina. In January of this year, the Department of Homeland Security unveiled their national response plan. This was supposed to be a blueprint in the post-September 11th world for how we were going to deal with a massive catastrophe. While certainly terrorism was an emphasis behind this document, it very clearly says that this is to be used when you have a major catastrophic natural disaster such as a hurricane. And what's surprising is when you listen to the testimony yesterday by the former FEMA director, it seems to be in conflict with what the plan calls for in a catastrophe. It very clearly says that in a catastrophe where you either anticipate or it has already happened that locals have become overwhelmed by the situation, both in terms of resources and the structure, that the federal government is supposed to take a proactive take proactive steps to protect the lives of citizens, and it says that. While there has been a lot of talk about how locals didn't make certain specific requests, the plan says that all the standard procedures for requiring requests can be waived in these kinds of situations. And while federal authorities are supposed to notify and if they can and coordinate with states, it says in the plan that the coordination process should not delay or impede the rapid mobilization and deployment of critical federal resources. Ultimately, this plan designates the Secretary of Homeland Security as the person who is supposed to be the principal federal official in charge when disaster strikes. Presidential directive by President Bush going several years back has designated the Secretary of Homeland Security as being in charge in domestic incidents. And so while Michael Brown very much was a point person down on the ground, There are a number of questions for Secretary Chertoff.
So you write about this memo saying Chertoff didn't shift power to Brown for 36 hours after the hurricane. Talk more about that.
Sure. Part of what triggers this so-called proactive federal response is designating an event what they call an incident of national significance. This is a new term that is coming into play in the whole emergency management sector as part of the national response plan. Secretary Chertoff, the plan says that it is up to the Secretary of Homeland Security to make that designation. He did not do that until about 36 hours after Katrina struck, even though that designation can be made when a catastrophe is known to be imminent. And in doing that, 36 hours after the event, he empowered Michael Brown to be the principal federal official in charge. We have lots of questions about what the delay in making that designation, how that may have impeded the lines of authority, whether by not having that designation, the FEMA director was in a position to merely ask and coordinate as opposed to really step up to the plate in what is a hierarchical structure that puts a federal official basically saying, look, we need to coordinate everyone and we want to work with you, but we also have a duty to get federal resources into the area to help people.
I mean, the chronology is quite something. When you say Chertoff didn't shift the power to Brown until late on the evening of August 30th, that's 36 hours after Hurricane Katrina. And then on the day that Chertoff wrote the memo, Bush in San Diego, presiding over the ceremony marking the 60th anniversary of the end of World War II. And then we had that pretty well-known picture now of Bush with the guitar because he's with a country music singer on that day that the people of New Orleans are sinking. Chertoff's 30th memo, August 30th, for the first time declaring Katrina an incident of national significance. Then August 31st, the Department of Defense, whose troops and equipment are crucial in such large disasters, activated its task force, Katrina, but active duty troops didn't move in large numbers to the Gulf Coast until Saturday. Where
right.
are the explanations as you pursue this story from the White House?
We have not had much luck getting good explanations. Ever since we wrote that article, the Department of Homeland Security has now been while the day after Secretary Chertoff designated Katrina an incident of national significance, he held a press conference and made a pretty big deal about how this was the first time ever he had implemented the national response plan and an incident of national significance. After that story ran and they started being asked more questions by us and other media, they're now downplaying and saying that it really didn't make much of a difference at all, that this was merely a paperwork matter. They are saying that because President Bush had declared a state of emergency, had issued an emergency declaration for Louisiana and Mississippi a few days prior to the storm, that essentially was the same thing as declaring it an incident of national significance. However, while the National Response Plan does in fact define things that may qualify as incidents of national significance as things that meet the definition for an emergency or a disaster declaration by the president, it says specifically that it's the Secretary of Homeland Security who makes that declaration. And also, if they were treating it as an incident of national significance prior to that time, they have not been able to offer us any explanation why from April 1st of this year until Katrina, there had been 20 federal emergency and disaster declarations that had been issued, but not a single one of those was touted as an incident of national significance. We are still asking a lot of questions about the mechanics, about how was it that critical federal resources got into the area, what role Secretary Chertoff's designation coming 36 hours after Katrina struck, what role that played. But we're having a hard time getting answers.
So you asked the Department of Homeland Security about Chertoff's schedule. They haven't responded?
They have now talked to us a bit in generalities about his schedule. One of the things that is of interest in his schedule is While they say that he was very actively involved in monitoring what was going on with Hurricane Katrina, we were able to find out that, after the storm struck, he went to the CDC in Atlanta for a previously scheduled briefing on avian flu. And it wasn't until he was on his way back that, he started crafting the language for the memo that declared it an incident of national significance.
For those who say this is simply a partisan attack, it's interesting to see your interview with a former FEMA director under President Reagan, General Becton.
Right. There have been several of my colleagues who have been involved in this story, and that interview was done by one of them. But we have had a number of concerns raised by FEMA officials who have served under both Republican and Democratic administrations, who have raised significant concerns about what happened here in the response. They have raised concerns about why there are a lot of questions right now about are there greater authorities needed, when in fact for many years FEMA in this country had done a pretty good job in responding to major natural disasters and other incidents.
We're talking to Allison Young, one of the authors of the Knight Ridder piece, Chertoff Delayed Federal Response Memo Shows. We're also on the phone from Washington, D.C. by Michael Grunwald, reporter for the Washington Post. He wrote a recent article that looks at Senator Trent Lott, Mississippi Republican's successful efforts to stop a ban on casinos being built on the Mississippi coast. Now, how does that play in here, the story of casino development and Hurricane Katrina? Michael Grunwald.
Well, in, back when those casinos were being stuck on the waterfront there around Biloxi and Gulfport, there was actually some concern by the Clinton administration appointee who was helping to oversee the Army Corps of Engineers that they were building in harm's way and destroying the coastal marshlands over there. And he decided there would be a moratorium on casino development over there, which was politically extremely explosive. The next thing he knew, there were frantic calls running around, and Senator Lott ended up triggering an investigation of this particular appointee to see whether he had a conflict of interest, because he and his brother-in-law were both working for environmental protection in the Mississippi area.
It's interesting. Your piece, along with Jane Mayer's piece in The New Yorker called High Stakes on Trent Lott's Bad Bet, she writes that Carol Browner was head of the Environmental Protection Agency during the Clinton administration when many casinos in Mississippi were constructed. Speaking from her office at the Washington consulting firm where she now works, Browner recalled the difficulties that her department experienced years ago when they tried to persuade legislators, including Mississippi Senator Trent Lott, that building on wetlands was environmentally risky. Developers and the politicians who supported them argued that gambling would attract commerce to the state. The proposed casinos, Browner said, were supposed to be in the water because the state didn't want them on solid land. To accommodate the moral qualms of conservative locals, the legislature relegated gambling to navigable waters, she went on. And but Browner says, but they were huge and they were right up against the shore. If you put structures this big into an estuary, you're disrupting the aquatic life and changing the habitat and eradicating wetlands, which has a huge effect on drainage. The wetlands act like a sponge in a storm. They're an incredibly smart and helpful part of nature, but they have to be kept moist like a sponge on your kitchen counter. If they're dried out and developed, they don't work. The shoreline's a very important buffer in the storm. And she said the more that they press to protect the wetlands, Lott was particularly single-minded in his support of casino development. She said, I had barely taken office, Browner said, when I discovered there was a hold on a department nominee. She said, I didn't have a clue on who put the hold on the nominee. Then Trent Lott called me up and said he'd done it. He told me, I figured I'd have a problem with the EPA. I don't have one yet, but this is a warning to you. Then he lifted the hold, but the message was clear. What about Trent Lott's power and the irony of his, one of his homes, I suppose his summer home in Mississippi, being totally destroyed by Hurricane Katrina, along with so many of his neighbors?
Well, I mean, he was Senate Majority Leader at the time. He was, the Republicans were raising a lot of money from gambling companies. I remember around that time, Lott took a flight on Steve Wynn's corporate jet to a fundraiser out in Vegas. You know, as for...
And Steve Wynn is...
As for Senator Lott's house, I mean, you know...
Steve Wynn is...
Oh, he's a very large casino operator. You know, his house, Senator Lott, built in Pascagoula, and it's a place that's had a tough time. I think a lot of people built in harm's way. I don't think it's ironic. I mean, in any sense of the word. I mean, it's just, you know, it's sad for him like it's sad for everybody who lost their house.
This issue of ultimately how something like this can be avoided again in terms of the level of destruction, though, is interesting with actually looking at who is responsible for the erosion of the wetlands.
Well, I mean, let's make it straight. I mean, the damage in Mississippi, particularly coastal Mississippi, was not because of the loss of coastal wetlands. It was because it got hit by a Category 4 hurricane. And those coastal wetlands would not have, particularly on the Mississippi side, would not have done a heck of a lot to stop the damage. Now, you can, on Louisiana side, there have been 80 years of loss of wetlands it's a much more complex situation. It's not because somebody built a casino on the shoreline. It's because the Army Corps of Engineers has been building levees along the Mississippi that stopped the kind of natural delta building process. It's because oil and gas companies have built canals and there have been public navigation canals. And over time, that has diminished. You know, they've been losing 25 square miles of marshes a year, and that certainly had some effect. Again, not necessarily a dispositive effect, but an effect on the storm surges. But I think if what you're getting at is that people have built in harm's way, that's certainly true, and there are a lot of sometimes perverse government incentives that have allowed people to build in harm's way. But I don't think you can blame the damage to Trent Lott's house or most of the other damage in Mississippi to the fact that that tidal flows in the estuary were being blocked by casinos.
Well, I was just reading your piece as you talk about the Mississippi Delta, scientists noting the most engineered and industrialized delta in the world, but disaster struck anyway. The levees only, you know, being constructed for a Category 3 hurricane. And then you quote Jane Bullock, chief of staff of FEMA under Clinton, saying there's only two kinds of levees, one that have failed and those that will fail. And Benigno Aguirre, the professor at the Disaster Research Center at University of Delaware, the disaster in New Orleans is not an act of God. This is an act of man. The federal government refused to spend the money to improve levees.
Right, and now for New Orleans, I think it's a much more complex situation. All I was saying is that Mississippi was hit by, you know, Mississippi. You build on the coast, you know, you take, you know, you pay your monies and you take your chances. But New Orleans was certainly a much more complex situation where, you know, some of years of engineering and trying to control nature. And in some senses, very successfully controlling nature by reducing Mississippi River floods may have contributed to the vulnerability of the city, which is, after all, below sea level and sitting in a bowl. So that's a slightly different situation than the casinos, which you know, Trent Lott fought to make sure those casinos could be in harm's way. They were put in harm's way, and they ended up getting flung all over the place. But the casinos, I don't think you could say, caused additional damage to the rest of Mississippi. They just got a lot of they thanks to their political juice, they were able to sit where they were for so long and make a lot of money where they were. And then it didn't end up so well for them. But now, of course, the casino companies are trying to get bailed out like everybody else.
Well, Michael Grunwald, I want to thank you for joining us, reporter with The Washington Post. And when we come back, Bill Arkin joining us, former Army intelligence analyst and consultant, runs a blog on The Washington Post website called Early Warning about the military being called in, something that Allison Young also is writing about at Knight Ridder. Stay with us. Wish Someone Would Care by New Orleans singer Irma Thomas here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a minute, we're going to talk with the St. Patrick's Four, but first to William Arkin in Vermont, writes a blog called Early Warning on the WashingtonPost.com website. He, too, has written about how Michael Brown is being scapegoated for the government's mistakes in responding to Katrina. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. I assume you heard or read about the hearing yesterday. Can you talk about that issue of scapegoating? And also, what about the role of the armed forces? Now that President Bush has gotten back on his feet, he keeps talking about an expanded role for the military in this country.
Well, I do believe that Michael Brown is not the official in the American government who was ultimately responsible for the failure of the federal government's response. In that regard, he was set up. But, gee, I have to also say at the same time, it's about time that somebody in the Bush administration has been held accountable for something. So, unfortunately for Mr. Brown, he happened to be the most convenient and most available person to be held accountable at a time when the Bush administration really needed to demonstrate that it actually cared about what Americans felt. From this whole debate, there has been an unfortunate outcome, kind of typical to Washington, I suppose, which is this notion that since FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security failed so miserably with Katrina, that we should just assign the mission to the military, and that somehow even the military was not able to provide all of its expertise and forces because there were laws that impeded the president using them for that task. Both of these notions are just dead wrong. First of all, there's really nothing that prevents the President of the United States from declaring a national emergency and using the military in this type of circumstance. And second, I, for one, am extremely uncomfortable with the notion that we're going to supplant civilian authority by using the military to deal with disasters in the United States. And also, as an American, I'm just incredibly ticked off with the notion that we spend $100 billion a year for a new Department of Homeland Security, and we're letting it get off the hook in terms of its responsibility for this basic function.
Allison Young, you've also been writing about the increased role of the military. What have you found?
Well, it has long been known that in a major catastrophe, the military would need to play a major role. Hurricane Andrew down in Florida, one of the things that was documented in numerous GAO reports was that they are the only entity in the government that has the helicopters and the ability to get massive amounts of supplies into an area. So this has long been known, although it's now being discussed in a way as if it's come as a surprise. The issue of should the military be in charge, the issue with Katrina is there doesn't appear to have been anyone who was in charge. And the question that seems to be not being discussed is, you know, what happened? Why wasn't anyone in charge? Before we start asking should the military be in charge, we need to be asking, you know, what happened with Katrina and why can't a civilian agency make this kind of thing happen? Hmm.
William Arkin, in just a minute, we're going to go to a peace protest around the invasion of Iraq. But you write about Michael Brown being set up and about the same obsession that led the Bush administration to see weapons of mass destruction and terrorism in every tea leaf and go to war in Iraq now guides the entire federal government disaster response effort. How do you prove this point?
Well, I think that you have to look at that very national response plan that people have been referring to today and other Department of Homeland Security emergency planning documents to see quite clearly what the emphasis of this new department has been since 9/11, and that's terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. I went through the documents and counted up how many times weapons of mass destruction and terrorism were mentioned versus how many times natural disasters, earthquakes, and hurricanes were mentioned. And I think the final score was something like 1,200 mentions of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction to 45 mentions of hurricanes and earthquakes. And I mean, it's a clever way of making my case, but the truth of the matter is that even when you look at the catastrophic incident annex of the National Response Plan, that is the annex that in theory should have guided expeditious federal actions in Louisiana and Mississippi, the truth of the matter is that it's biased towards preparing for a terrorist or weapons of mass destruction event. It's not biased towards a natural disaster. And so I think that the question of sort of authorities, the question of preparations, the question of how the military knits with the civil government and how the civil government uses those resources of the military have not been resolved because the government has been mesmerized by a new mission, which is counterterrorism and preparing for a weapons of mass destruction incident in American cities. And has not just paid attention to the bread and butter of natural disasters. Now, having said that, of course, I do have to agree with one thing that Michael Brown said yesterday at his hearing, which is that FEMA as a corporate entity, the FEMA professionals have and do focus on this question, and there's really no need for a reorganization of government in that regard. But I think that this notion that somehow because Michael Brown was incompetent and in above his head, that somehow a bunch of 18-year-olds with guns in the American military are going to be disaster preparedness and disaster response specialists for the American public is just completely and utterly ridiculous. The U.S. military ingests about 35,000 18-year-olds every year to put through basic training to essentially be cannon fodder in American military activities. And the notion that somehow these young kids are going to be the disaster response specialists that FEMA is, I think, is not only wrongheaded, but obviously it would raise a whole set of new problems on American streets.
Well, William Markin, I want to thank you for joining us, author of Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World, also a blogger at WashingtonPost.com, Early Warnings is that blog, as well as Allison Young, reporter for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Thanks for joining us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. On Monday, a federal jury in Binghamton, New York, acquitted four Catholic peace activists of felony conspiracy charges stemming from an anti-war action on the eve of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The St. Patrick's Four, as the defendants were known, were convicted on lesser charges of damage to government property and entering a military station for an unlawful purpose. But the ruling on the felony charge represents a setback for the Bush administration's attempts to crack down on dissent, as this was the first federal conspiracy case against anti-war activists since the Vietnam War. The prosecutor in the case was Assistant U.S. Attorney Miroslav Lavrik. He characterized the four activists as violent, saying, quote, "It's dead wrong to say this was civil disobedience. It was not. I found it disgusting that they were comparing themselves to all these people in history who were nonviolent," he said. The prosecutor also compared them to Timothy McVeigh, saying he felt justified when he blew up the Oklahoma City Federal Building in 1995. The prosecutor said, quote, "If people are allowed to destroy property, it's a slippery slope." The St. Patrick's Four carried out their action March 2003 when they entered a recruiting center in suburban Ithaca, poured their own blood on the walls and the foyer and on a U.S. flag, and then refused to leave. Here is some of the scene from that day as two of the four read their statement defining their action at the recruitment center.
"Apologies, dear friends, for the fracture of good order as our nation prepares to escalate the war on the people of Iraq by sending hundreds of thousands of U.S. soldiers to invade. We pour our blood on the walls of this military recruiting center. We mark this recruiting office with our own blood to remind ourselves and others of the cost in human life of our government's war making. Killing is wrong. Preparations for killing are wrong. The work done by the Pentagon with the connivance of this military recruiting station ends with the shedding of blood, and God tells us to turn away from it. Blood is the symbol of life. All life is holy. All people are created in the image and likeness of God. All people are family, and everyone is loved by God."
The statement of the St. Patrick's Four at their action March 17, 2003, on the eve of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. We're now joined by two of the St. Patrick's Four, Daniel Burns and Teresa Grady. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
So
thank
your
you.
Response to the verdict, explain the significance, Daniel.
Well, we weren't charged with pouring blood. We were charged with conspiracy to impede an officer using force.
Intimidation and threat.
And the idea of that is it's very vague, and it carries 6-year prison term. And had we been convicted of it, they could apply it anywhere they wanted to. If you had gone, and anybody who had done any resistance at any military or government location, they could apply it. Anybody who signed the pledge of resistance against the war in Iraq, they could apply it. And the idea of instilling fear of 6 years in prison, a $250,000 fine on anybody who even just, who knows where they would. I mean, we know what they're capable of, clearly, but it was a big victory for the peace movement.
And, Teresa, the argument of the prosecutor that it's a slippery slope between you and Timothy McVeigh, mm-hmm. once you start destroying property.
Well, I think that it was very clear that international law and the law of justification, which says that you, while what would otherwise be considered a crime is not a crime when you're trying to avert a greater crime from happening, that was not allowed in the courtroom. And we feel quite confident that the other two charges that we were actually convicted on, which was damage to property and trespassing, in fact, would have also been acquittals had the jury been given the legal justification to work on or to use as they deliberated. And so the slippery slope is just his way of once again inducing fear in people in order to try to keep people maintaining the status quo, I think.
Did you throw your own blood?
I poured my own blood, yes.
Why?
I didn't throw anything.
Why?
Well, because blood cuts right to it. When you see blood, and maybe for a moment, your heart rate changes, and for a moment, maybe you could imagine what it must be like, what war would be like, and to go in there to carry the message about this war and about the potential catastrophe to for our country and for the Iraqis and for the children of Iraq. That, I mean, we are daily killing children in Iraq. And just for a moment, if they could see this and maybe just get it a little more than reading it in the newspaper, say, it just brings it, makes it more real to them, I believe.
Just in terms of looking at the blood on the cutouts, there were really beautiful service people portrayed in these stand-up cutouts, welcoming people into the vestibule, which is where we did pour the blood. And to see the blood dripping on these very well-dressed and very happy-looking people was just kind of elicited or showed the perversity of what war is about without words.
And there's no mention of blood in any of the literature. There's no mention of being taught to kill or being killed or having to live the rest of your life having been exposed to all the depleted uranium and such in Iraq. It is clearly, it's an advertisement. And so the blood really just brought truth to the recruiting center.
This being the first federal conspiracy case against anti-war activists mm-hmm. since the Vietnam War, that goes back to, well, a family tradition, Teresa Grady. Sure. Your father.
Yeah, my dad was charged with a number of conspiracy charges. All totaled, if he had been found guilty on them all, would have brought him 45 years in jail. However, the jury acquitted the Camden 28, which my father was a part of, in when they went in and destroyed draft records of young men who were part of this in the selective service of the Camden offices.
In New Jersey.
In New Jersey.
And your father's name?
John Peter Grady.
Mm-hmm. Is he still alive?
He's passed away in 2002, just before Phil died, Phil Berrigan. He died in October.
And so you do face jail time now. You'll each be sentenced separately?
We do, yeah.
Separate days in sequential order. The judge said that's where the dates came up, and that's where they got us. No
in
special
January.
Treatment.
Yeah.
In January, yes, for two misdemeanors.
Yeah. January 24th, 25th, 26th, and 27th.
Those you think it was worth it?
Absolutely.
That was definitely worth it. We had two trials. We were able to raise awareness. The idea wasn't to try and get out of jail. The idea was to try to stop the war in conjunction with others around the country right before it happened. You know, obviously we didn't do that, but we were able to raise awareness against the war. And so if we could, if I have to do some time in jail to try and stop this war any sooner, then I would gladly
Daniel Burns, Teresa Grady, I want to thank you very much for being with it. That does it for today's program, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdokadush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. We are also looking for flat screen monitors and information to mail at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.